And in the recent Vatican Bank scandals, this Pope appointed a four-man committee to study and clean up the Vatican finances, and it included his old boss and Hitler's personal banker, Hermann Ops. When presented with this problem by the World Jewish Congress, he said he couldn't remember who Ops was. It was this Pope also elevated Opus Dei to the status of a religious order, and it now has 72,000 members in 80 countries. The Knights of Malta head in the United States was Cardinal Spellman, protege of the collaboration during World War II with the Nazis, and the really spiritual leader here for the Knights of Malta is responsible for introducing him to Alan Dulles and then proposing that he become president of South Vietnam to Kennedy. And when Diem resisted American troops coming into Vietnam, Dulles told Westmoreland to go ahead and put the troops in, and then RCIA helped to kill Diem. Avery Dulles, the son of John Foster Dulles, and a nephew of Alan Dulles, at the time when they were Secretary of State and Director, respectively, worked with Martin Bormann to help him escape to Argentina, and now works as an advisor at the Georgetown University and is a key member of the Knights of Malta. Alder Haig, the protege of Fritz Kramer, has links as well through International NATO to the fascist cell that was exposed in Italy called P2 and DUE. Lucio Gelli, master of the cell, worked with Franco and Mussolini as dual citizenship in both Italy and Argentina, and developed a secret order of Freemasons who scandalized and rocked the whole Italian government when their relations came to bear and got public notice. And many of these key figures are in prison now, though Lucio Gelli's out, but Michele Sindona was in prison for a while and is now dead, and Roberto Calvi is dead. These are the people that headed up the Vatican Bank during its scandal period. And Haig has been knighted into the Knights of Malta, which includes his brother, William Colby, William F. Buckley, J. Peter Grace, John McCone of the CIA, General Chris Reagan's roving ambassador, James Angleton of the CIA, and many, many others. His rocket team developed the first international experimental missiles at Piamunda. He worked for and the NASA security teams that built up around the post-war rocketry, aerospace industry, are also implicated in the assassination of John F. Kennedy. The actual physical capture of von Braun and his scientists, which was a prearranged order at the concentration camp to build these rockets, was done by an American officer, aide de camp Clay Shaw, later charged by District Attorney Jim Garrison for his role in a conspiracy to kill Kennedy. And General Walter Dornberger, who was the mentor for von Braun, and who was standing to be convicted for his work at Nuremberg with the Butcher of Auschwitz and killing 6,000 Jews, was scheduled to be hung, according to the British prosecutor Shawcross. But von Braun said, "I won't do any rocket work for you here in the United States unless you save my friend Dornberger." And so we did. John J. McCloy granted him a pardon. He came to the United States. He worked at NASA. He became director of the helicopter division at Bell Aerospace in Dallas and Houston. He trained pilots abroad, worked with the Shah of Iran. In the 1960s, he employed a top-ranking military agent named Michael Payne. It was Michael Payne and his wife, Ruth, who housed Marina Oswald in their home in Irving, Texas. It was Mrs. Payne who got him the job in the book depository and helped set him up as the patsy in the case. And Marina came back with Oswald. She married him the fourth time she saw him. She was from an anti-communist white Russian family in Belarusia. And it was an openly anti-communist family. Other key figures include the most trusted man in America, so-called, Leon Jaworski, for his role in the Watergate and Greengate scandals. But he spent 20 years with the CIA Kaplan Foundation in Texas. He had been a lawyer at the Nuremberg trials and undermined the prosecution of the Nazis, and then worked with the Red Cross International Rescue Division to move the Odessa network around the world and he later was the special liaison to the Dallas police between them and the Warren Commission. In fact, even the author of the Warren Commission report was taken away from a job as an official Pentagon historian at the Army Historical Division. His name was Otto Winokur, and he had come to the United States after years as an official historian, one of 26 for Adolf Hitler. And Winokur wrote the report, and then internally, when I looked through the documents, even the phony investigative staff would say, line by line critique of the report, where does he reach this conclusion, what's the evidence for this? So the Nazis even wrote the final history of the Warren Commission itself. I want to move in that background, which I hope gave a little bit of an overview of the forces and some of the key players to the Bush family. Prescott Bush Sr., from British monarchy, monarch's family, registered the blue blood registers for England, graduated from Yale in 1919, the Skull and Bones, which is the secret society at Yale that taps 15 members per class year, who then later figure into the top positions in the ruling class. Skull and Bones took him on the year that he graduated. And one of the rituals that you do to be initiated in Skull and Bones, at least by report of those who've been there, is that you dig up somebody who was an anti-establishment figure and spend the evening in a coffin with their skull and bones. And word has it that his particular victim was Geronimo, and there were even some attempts by the elders of the Native American tribes to get the bones back in 1989-1990. I don't know what came of it. When Bush became president, I guess they thought they could ask, at least. Democracy. Also central in that graduating class were Averell Harriman and George Brown and the Brown brothers. Harriman banking interests who were responsible in large part, not solely, but in large part for the financing of Hitler into power via the Deutsche Bank and their operations on the board of the Deutsche Bank and the Bank of International Credit. Prescott Bush went into congressional office as senator during the Eisenhower and JFK years, Republican. He was supported in his drive to office by William F. Buckley and his National Review. And in 1941, Prescott was one of a committee of 100 men who placed an ad in 26 papers in California asking for someone to run as president, and that ad was responded to supposedly randomly by Richard Nixon. Prescott Bush also helped to set up the winning Eisenhower-Nixon ticket in 1950, and there are long-standing connections between Nixon and Bush circles. His son, Prescott Jr., is a member of the Knights of Malta, and I didn't go into a full list of who they are, but believe me, they're the ruling aristocracy of many, many countries within the ranks of the Catholic Church, including this country, people top levels of hidden government intelligence control. And his other son, who we now getting to know so well, George Herbert Walker Bush. Bush, the younger Bush, also graduated from Yale in 1939, was similarly tapped for Skull and Bones. I don't know which division he was in. There's a Woolstead division and a Deathstead division, just like the SS. I don't know which one he got. And he was in, and he was said to have dug up Emma Goldman bones. I would say, I hope she fit him. But Rockefeller and Kissinger and Buckley, these were the money circles that he grew up in. Rockefeller had worked, I mentioned, with C.D. Jackson and Nixon with the importation of Nazis, and later with Rockefeller worked with Edwin Lansdale for the mind control operations from 1948 on. And he began a career in Texas oil speculation. James Baker and Mr. Mosbacher, who are both in the administration now with him, were his early partners in oil barge drilling and exploration offshore. He formed Zapata Offshore Oil. He eventually had extensive dealings throughout Mexico, looking for Mexican oil there, and set up phony fronts. The Mexican government doesn't like speculation to come from outside, so they often pay somebody to pretend to be the Mexican, indigenous Mexican contact, and he operated that way with several people, Mr. Serrano among them. And he knew Kerr McGee. I think he might have known Oswald's case officer and babysitter of the CIA, George Mornshield, who was a petroleum engineer in Mexico and some of the areas where he was in those years. I think from early on, probably by the 1950s, he was already a CIA asset and operant. This new book that's out in the last few years, Cloak and Gown, has a lot to do with the Yale graduates and moving them into OSS. CIA, the first recruiting ground, and of course, Skull and Bones was one of the main agencies that would be sought in that recruiting effort. It's an inside club. In the 1960s, he was actively working with the CIA on the Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba. He worked to recruit anti-Castro Cuban exiles in Florida and in Miami with Mr. Rodriguez, of current contradict and other infamy. Rodriguez is the person that's reported to have interrogated and then killed Che Guevara. I don't think he interrogated him. I do think he was in the team that killed him. Bolivian secret police, the CIA, and Green Berets cut him in half with machine gun fire. I talked to one of the Berets that was there, and Rodriguez probably went up afterwards and took off his watch. He's about that bold. And they were also working at that time with key CIA operatives, Theodore Shackley, Rafael Quintero, Frank Sturgis, and there were also links through Buckley to the whole Mexico situation. Buckley is the godfather of E.R. Hunt's children. Hunt was a CIA station chief in Mexico City at the time right before the Kennedy assassination, and followed up by David Abney Phillips. And these were the people who were forming the kill teams for Operation Mongoose and Operation 40 to go after Castro ostensibly, but then those same teams got turned back very successfully against John F. Kennedy. The Houston Post reported an FBI memo that a George H.W. Bush of the CIA in 1963 was in Dallas and reported to the FBI on a conversation by right-wing planners that were attempting to kill JFK. There was another memo that surfaced under Freedom of Information Act from the FBI that said that there was a George Bush, a CIA agent in Miami, working with the anti-Castro Cuban exiles. On November the 22nd, 1963, he was interviewed in order to find out what their reaction was to the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Bush is one of very few people I've ever seen in print say that they cannot recall where they were on November 22nd, 1963. One of the most infamous of those is Richard Milhouse Nixon. He told the Warren Commission in a deposition he couldn't recall where he was that day. It took him 13 years to remember that he'd been in Dallas, Texas. He'd been there for several days at meetings with the Murchison Oil family, with J. Edgar Hoover and others planning the assassination of John Kennedy. Helps your memory. At that point in time, I can't remember a thing. But he was there. Richard Helms is another one who says he can't remember. He was at the swimming pool at Bobby Kennedy's home, I think as an ear, waiting to see if Bobby said the wrong thing or would react immediately when he got news from Hoover that his brother was dead. But Bush says, and Rodriguez now says, they can't recall what they were doing that day. And it's a common enough experience within anybody over a certain age. I think maybe people here who weren't even on the planet yet with us, November 22nd, 63, but those that were probably 5 years and older recall it enough that it's a commonly used amnesia-breaking technique by psychiatrists, psychologists to get people to remember their lives by taking back to that point. Doesn't rock the memory of people like this, though. This Bay of Pigs team really comprised of a lot of the Texas oil men, Standard Oil people that had lost property and money when Kessler took over. Buckley lost family oil money down there to Marnshield, that started a Cuban-Venezuelan oil company and invested in that, lost a fortune. That was the second time he lost an oil fortune. His family had lost interest in the Nobel oil fields, which are like the Rockefellers of Russia under the Tsar, and been kicked out. Jack Crichton was working with this team out of Texas, an Air Force general named Charles Cabell, whose brother was the mayor of Dallas the day Kennedy was shot, and who was fired from the CIA by Kennedy for these operations. And these were the circles of people that, that Bush would have been working with back in 1963. He was taking regular trips between Houston and Miami, and also down there in Mexico were the extensive operations of training the assassins going on in Oaxaca under the auspices of John Howard Bowen, who had ties with the Central Intelligence Agency, and they trained these assassins down there for the Kennedy hit. In the 1970s, Gerald Ford and Nelson Rockefeller are the appointed presidents for their work by that point. You don't even have to get elected by then. And they appoint Bush to head the CIA following these multiple scandals that are sinking credibility of the agency. And so he comes in then 1976 up until the beginning of the Carter years when he's replaced by Stansfield Turner. And he closely lost a Senate race in 1970 to Lloyd Benson. He was a representative of the United States of the United Nations. He was an ambassador to China and turned down a chance to speak to Mao Zedong while he was there. But he helped put Deng in power, the person that's in control now, and began to work on the privatization of China by the U.S. Corporate forces. And paved the way for some of the ties there that are bearing fruit in the current period with the turn to the right of the Chinese government. He was also heading up the Republican National Committee during the critical period of Watergate when Nixon was moved out. Nelson Rockefeller was eventually murdered, I believe, to keep Nixon in power, as well as several other people. And I think many of these scandals, like Watergate, Contragate, even the BCCI scandals breaking out, are orchestrated scandals by one segment of the ruling class fighting with another, trying to push them one direction or another. And we get a chance to look in the window when these scandals open. There's a new book out now talking about Watergate and that thesis. I've finished reading it. It's called Silent Coup, but it properly puts the finger on Mr. Radford and the Joint Chiefs of Staff as helping to set Nixon up to fall. There's a difference between being framed and being cornered, and Nixon was the latter. And also, Bush eventually moved into jobs as vice president with Reagan to head up both the counterterrorism task force and the anti-drug task force, both of which succeeded memorably under his direction by increasing the world drug trade and the international terrorism that's operated out of CIA centers worldwide. During the year that he was in the CIA, he was attempting to cut the losses of the congressional investigation. When Stansfield Turner came in, right after Bush, he kicked out whole sections in the operations division and 158 people were fired. And it was right at that point also that Task Force 158 of the Office of Naval Intelligence was formed with Oliver North as the head, and many of these fired agents working continuously with the off-the-shelf operations of William Casey and these others. Bush headed up those disaffected CIA elements just before they got dumped. And the CIA was also working with the DINA and the death squads in Latin America with the handmaidens of death, with the AAA and these killing groups. It was during that period that Orlando Bosch worked in CIA's run circles to do terrorism around the world and worked with the Chilean and Paraguayan killers. So we had U.S. CIA agents down there as well doing this training. One of them was Michael Townley Welch, who later was instrumental in planting the bomb that killed the Chilean ambassador Letelier in the United States. And Welch worked at a Chilean concentration and murder camp called Colonia Dignidad, where Mengele and Bormann had both visited in those years. And there were other top CIA trainers that brought this technology down there. In 1976, there was a cover-up going on in the agency of the CIA role in the overthrow of Allende and the coup that put Pinochet in power that involved Richard Helms, and Bush assisted in that cover-up. The Richard Welch scandal broke during that time, but one of the CIA agents in Greece was killed, and they tried to blame it on covert operations information bulletin and some of the few groups that were getting information out about the CIA rather than the CIA activities in Greece. The Pike Committee was going on at that point. They were blocked from getting key documents by both the DIA and the CIA and discredited. The beginnings of the long manipulation in Angola and the false stories about Soviet intervention in Angola were spread during those years, that year in Bush's reign. He appointed William Wells and Theodore Shackley and Mr. Waller to cover up the congressional problems. Covert operations happened at least on a massive scale with insertions of our CIA into the intelligence agencies of South Korea and Argentina, Chile, Iran, Philippines, and South Africa, many countries around the world. And these Old Bay of Pigs veterans, they were still in touch with them. Watergate and R. Barker said he hadn't seen them for 20 years, but it took him 10 minutes to get in touch with them. And they were a standing army, and they began to form a group of reactionary killers called CORU, especially in Paraguay and Nicaragua. Ciaga took over from the Democratic, the elected, but IM, International Monetary Fund, opposed Michael Manley in Jamaica. Orlando Bosch was part of Operation Candor, which was an attempt to use agents internationally to do the killing of the people they opposed that were living in exile or in other countries so that you wouldn't suspect a person comes in from one country and kills somebody for another intelligence agency. And it was the period when Kevin Mulcahy blew the whistle on Edwin Wilson's international gun and terrorist training operations, supposedly outside the CIA, but he made the mistake of blowing that whistle to Theodore Shackley and Mr. Kleins and Quintero, who were in these operations, and so Kevin Mulcahy is dead long before any of this came to trial. And Bush also knew that the agents were moving up into the United States from Operation Condor that eventually killed Letelier, but did nothing to intercept them. In 1980, now we have an even broader scandal about Bush emerging in the 90s, that he was involved in something called October Surprise. And probably for most of you, I don't have to go into great detail about it, but it's a report came out in November of 1986 in a Lebanese newspaper that Robert McFarlane had secretly negotiated a deal to hold the Iranian hostages until Reagan was elected. And they attempted to go to damage control and to have an incomplete investigation to stop that. The Reagan and Bush campaign had secretly pursued meetings as early as September of 1980, and there was an October Surprise group within the Reagan-Bush campaign team, 10 strategists, Richard Allen, Dr. Fred Hickel, and John Lehman, among them, who in turn were affiliated to many foreign policy and national security consultants. And so there was a way to get White House information out to the campaign, including eventually the theft of the Carter debate books, which involved Sven Kramer, Fritz Gustav, Anton Kramer's son. And the final deal was apparently cut in the last 2 weeks of October in Paris. And representing the Reagan-Bush team at that point was George Bush himself, according to former Iranian President Bonnie Sadr, who now says he wants to come and testify in the United States. None of this was being taken seriously in the last few years when it was initially exposed, but timeline is October the 3rd, Bush announced publicly that Carter was planning an October surprise to win the election by bringing the hostages home. And then the remaining question is, after that, did Bush go to Paris? Between the days of October 18th and 19th, those 2 days, Bush can't account for a 21-hour period. And according to many sources, he was flown to Paris at that point by Jack Tolliver or a pilot named Ken Qualls to have a meeting with Casey, Richard Allen, Fred Hickel, McFarland, who was John Tower's aide at that point, and the Iranians to give arms in exchange for this hostage holdup. The people who say he did that include Mr. Brennecke, a former CIA agent, Bonnie Sauter, Mr. Rafizadeh from Sabah, the CIA's William Herman, if Brennecke is to be believed, Donald Gregg, the National Security Advisor to Bush, confirmed, several Mossad agents that were contacted. There's varying levels of attacks on these people's credibility, but I think the orchestration of the release of hostages on the very day that within hours of Reagan's inauguration, as well as the shipment right after that, the arms, should tell us it's certainly not something outside the purview of what they would try to do. And many of the people who started to expose it and talk about it are already dead. And I expect more deaths will follow as the investigation opens. March 31st, 1980, then I would contend Bush fails. Oil in the 1960s, another oil was floundering, called Vanderbilt Oil. Vanderbilt changed its name to Vanderbilt versus, and in the 1980 had 65 wells, $14 million a year income, which I think was a funnel, of course. Vanderbilt Oil is run by Scott Hinckley, Hinckley Sr. Besides being on the board of World CIA and USAID in the 1950s and 1960s, and that spied in Vietnam and throughout Southeast Asia for that ran the Cuban enhanced using the Bay of Pigs operatives who actually physically controlled. They also ran the house of the Thai refugees, and one of the people that worked for Roy was Mark David Chapman, the individual who later assassinated John Lennon, were in charge of these camps where the fascist Falange went in and killed the Palestinians. And they have many overseas operations to recruit and train assassins worldwide. Hinckley is also very close to the Christian right, and very close friends with Chuck Colson, among others, a large figure. Lennon's death and silence was used to usher in the emerging Reagan-Bush warfare state in the 1980s and 90s. Hinckley's son, Scott, was very close with the Bush family and good friends with Neil Bush. In fact, Neil Bush and Scott Hinckley were supposed to have dinner the night of the Reagan shooting on March 31st. And according to some reports, canceled their plans, and other reports said they didn't. But if I told you that Robert Oswald, Lee's older brother, was going to have dinner with Lyndon Johnson's daughter the night of the Kennedy assassination, I think you'd get the point. In fact, all of Scott Hinckley's dating arrangements were being made by George Bush's daughter. And they came into those days in March of 1980, and there was a little fight going on in the White House weeks before about something called the Crisis Management Team. And at first, Haig was going to head up the Crisis Management Team, but then at the last minute, about 3 days before the shooting, Bush was put in to head the Crisis Management Team. And the press couldn't quite figure out what it was, and they were chasing him around saying, what's a crisis, and what's crisis management, what's this all got to do with? What it has to do with, of course, is transfer of power and control in either natural or created crises in the White House and at the level of the presidency. So they asked Bush 3 days before the shooting, how would you define a crisis? And Bush says, the president will know it when he sees it. Flat on his back, I suppose, was the scenario. And I think he did see it coming out of that Hilton there in Washington, and I did extensive work on the ballistics. None of Hinckley's bullets hit Mr. Reagan. Hinckley had 6 bullets in the gun. One hit Delahanty, a cop, threw him to the ground. by nicking him on his, grazing his shoulder and neck. Another went into the groin of the Agent McCarthy. A 160-pound man lifted him up and threw him back to the other end of the limousine. Another bullet, the initial bullet fired by Hinckley, hit Mr. Brady in the head, knocked him to the ground, did considerable brain damage. And one bullet nicked the windshield of the limousine. One bullet went into the Universal office building across the street. And one bullet went into the trunk of the car. And you can see when you look at the photos closely, a very clear hole. Not a ricochet or a scar mark, but a hole going into the car penetrating the outer metal wall. Hinckley was firing a .38 caliber gun that he had purchased on instruction, I believe, to make it clear, on Elm Street in Dallas, Texas, the street where Kennedy was assassinated. Hinckley, the younger Hinckley, was an expendable member of the family. He wouldn't get with the corporate program with his father. He sat around the basement, in fact, and plunked John Lennon tunes on the guitar and thought about other things. They sent him out to see a psychiatrist who gave him biofeedback, as he called it, by attaching electrodes into his skull. And I think at that point programmed him. I think Mark David Chapman was similarly programmed at Castle Memorial Institute in Hawaii, where the psychiatrist ran part of the MKUltra program. This psychiatrist out there in Evergreen that saw Hinckley also saw a second individual who we unearthed in the research at Dublin, and named Richardson, who, following the Hinckley attempt, was picked up at the Port Authority, having gone up to New Haven and Yale, having written his own love letters to Jodie Foster from the same hotel, and coming down with a gun in his bag. He was stopped at Port Authority. I don't know if any of you have ever been to Port Authority in New York. It's a pretty big place. I don't know how you tell which guy coming off the bus has a gun in the luggage unless you know who you want to pick up. And this guy had worked with Carl McIntyre and the American Catholic Christian Churches, one of the groups connected to the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And he I think, was Team B or the second, but he had gone to the same psychiatrist as John Hinckley Jr. And the bullet that hit Reagan hit him, by all counts, at an early point. When the limousine pulled up to deliver him to this talk, it pulled up at the door where he was to go in. I suppose if you rented a limousine, you'd expect it to come to your door, not two doors down the block. If you're the President of the United States, they will move it 6 inches to make it sure it lines up at the door. They were following standard security procedure when he got there. The limousine stopped, the door opened. The Secret Service got out on both sides and formed a human wall. And then Reagan gets out and walks through that wall a couple of seconds into the door of the VIP entrance and through some non-public halls and an elevator and out on the stage. He comes back to the same route in order to beat the crowd out. This was specifically designed there at the Hilton for that purpose, this route. But when he comes out, the limousine inexplicably is about 40 feet down the curb, nowhere near the door. So he has to walk out into the open. When the President walks in the open, the Secret Service are supposed to stand on either side of the front and back, as well as other points, but at least a protective diamond. The Secret Service file out, all to his right. Line of ducks. They told him that morning, "No security problem, Mr. President, you needn't wear your vest." He raised his hand to wave. Some call Mr. President, raised his hand to wave, and at that point he's hit. You can tell he's hit, similar to the effect of Connolly and the Kennedy assassination, because the missile went into his lung. The lung begins to collapse, the air is blown out, and the cheeks expand. And you get a grimace on the face. His shoulder slumps a little bit, he's clearly in pain. And all of the magazines, Time magazine, go back to that point, show Reagan is hit. He's up like this. But that point is at almost the same second that Hinckley's first bullet is fired and hits Brady in the head. And realizing that Reagan is not dead, Secret Service Agent Parr begins to push him into the car in front of him. And Reagan's already in the car, and Parr about a third of the way into the car when Hinckley's last shot is fired. So there's no chance of timing or angle or anything else for these bullets to hit Reagan. The reaction of all the other people is much different than Reagan. Reagan's still standing, and then he gets in the car. So they're all lying on the ground from these 38 shots. If a 38 caliber, even a 22 caliber bullet had hit Reagan, he wouldn't have been wondering whether something had happened to him. A good assassin, even if you have your vest on, knows that when you raise your hand, you expose your heart. And the situation was that up top of the retaining wall, on an area that I call the Bushy Knoll, was the assassin. And he was firing not a 38 or a 22, but a very, very specific weapon developed by the intelligence agencies, which is a CO2 propelled flechette. These are little razor edged or sharp discs, or they have them, earlier versions were like little tube rockets, half an inch long, very thin with stabilizing fins. Then they got into these little discs that are razor edged and delt shaped or airline shaped, so that they. And this thing makes no noise, it's just little puffs, CO2 gas, and it can be fired with accuracy up to an amazing distance. Some of the guns that incorporated this sort of technology were revealed by Senator Church during the CIA assassination studies in Congress, and they had a, looked like a German Luger with a rifle scope on it that would fire these things accurately with a scope to the length of a football field.